What a Sunday, right? It's so awesome. You're going to see how well all this stuff fits in with my topic. It's kind of cool. To start off, I want to tell you about this book that we're featuring this month and possibly some into next because it's such a good book. It's called The Five Invitations by Frank Ostaseski. And this guy, I'll just call him Frank from now on. He is a Zen Buddhist monk who works as a hospice worker. And he's a chaplain, and he helps people make the transition from this body into the next life. And, you know, he has a lot of thoughts about death and dying. He talks about how death is around us always, even if we have no concept that that's going to happen to us someday. Does anybody here believe that's never going to happen to you? You know, you have sort of you kind of have this thought, and that may be actually the realist part of you that knows that you're eternal, but there is this sort of Woody Allen-esque thought that, you know, that's not going to happen to me, it's going to happen to other people. And yet, he says in the book that the awareness of death is what saves us. It's what can inspire us to live a life that is more precious and more meaningful. And so one time he was on a plane going to a seminar in, I believe it was Washington, D.C. He was flying from the West Coast to Washington, D.C. to speak with a bunch of people that worked in the death and dying field. And he said to himself, what does death really teach us? And he scribbled on a cocktail napkin. I wonder what he was drinking, by the way. Anyway, he scribbled on a cocktail napkin the five invitations, the five things that death asks us to look at. And those five invitations are, where are they? Okay. That they are don't wait, welcome everything, push nothing away. That's two. Three is bring your whole self to experience. Number four is find a place in the middle of things. Number five is cultivate don't know mind. Now, if you want to learn more about those, you're welcome to read the book, or I'll be speaking about some of them over the next couple of weeks. But the one that we're focusing on today is the second one, which is welcome everything, push nothing away. Welcome everything, push nothing away. And I chose that one because sometimes in the service I get questions afterwards about that business that we do after the sacred reading and after I Am Remembering, where I say, open your eyes, in love with what is, as it is, and so it is. And sometimes people don't want to be in love with what is because they don't like it, and that's okay. Being in love with what is doesn't mean that you have to like it. It means participating with what is in a way that is using the energy and the activity of love. That's a way of welcoming everything. So that's what this morning is about being with what is, loving what is, as it is, and so it is. As I was reading his chapter on welcoming everything, I came across this chapter that is about that and was reading it. And as I was reading it, I started to get this very sort of innate feeling of paradox. And often when you're talking about paradox, you know that you're onto something that's real. Paradox is often a sign of absolute reality because it kind of throws the ego off balance. And so the name of this talk this morning is called The Weirdest Paradox Ever. Okay? I shared that with a friend and he said, oh my gosh, that's a great talk title, and then went on to elaborate as to why it was a great talk title. Afterwards, he asked me, did you hear what I said? Don't you agree? And I was like, well, you know, you lost me after that was a great talk title. Thank you. Thank you. It's nothing, please. Thank you. And then I said, you know, really what I was trying to do is be kind of like a valley girl, the greatest paradox, the weirdest paradox ever, right? Oh my God, totally, totally, Megan. Oh my God, for sure. Grody to the max, right? So good, I'm glad I got that out of my system. Okay. Anyway, so the weirdest paradox ever, I think, is this. It really struck me as strange, and I hope you understand it like I do. And if not, I'm going to give you some explanation as to what I think I mean by this. To me, the weirdest paradox ever is that in order to transcend suffering, you have to suffer. Is that weird? It's really weird. And I hope that doesn't frighten anybody, but because it's not suffering like we may know suffering. It's skillful suffering. And that means welcoming your suffering and being with what is, participating with it in a state of love, loving what is, and then allowing something new to emerge from that willingness to participate in a state of love. Suffering also means allowing. Compassion means to suffer together. And so all of these things come together to create this opening. And we find that if we are willing to skillfully suffer with our suffering, it connects us to something deeper. It connects us to the flow of life and to something, this interconnectedness with all beings that we all share. You know, this came up. I do a weekly call conference with some of my friends from India. And one of the gentlemen is from Japan, and he said in Japan, in his practice, he has what he calls despair circles, where people sit around and talk about despair. And the people in the group were saying, how do you cope with that? How do you manage that? How do you keep yourself from getting sucked into despair? And he said, actually what happens is that as people start to be open about their despair and to talk about it and to be heard, then something transcendent happens. And people get connected at the level of that which is beyond despair. Something beneath the suffering. The interconnectedness that holds all of us. That which is below or beneath or surrounding the world of conditions that we live in. So that's what we're addressing today in various ways. And we'll see what happens. Because I didn't suffer over this talk at all. I'm just going to see what happens. Okay. I want to talk a little bit about some of the illusions about suffering, or some basic thoughts about suffering and what we tend to do with them, because we take really beautiful things as human beings and we mess them up. We can make ourselves wrong with anything. Have you noticed that? Right? Oh, good. I'm not the only one. Okay. So in the book, he talks about some of the things about suffering that you've probably heard before, that pain is inevitable and suffering is optional, right? And he also talks about how suffering is pain plus resistance. And if you've been around Buddhists or been around New Thought churches, you probably know that those things are things that are said a lot. But what I've observed sometimes in New Thought churches is that when we say that pain is inevitable and suffering is optional, is that people start to feel badly about suffering. They say, I must be doing it wrong because this is optional. But I'm still suffering. I'm doing something wrong. See, I'm not good enough. And that is suffering over your suffering. That is that is the opposite of skillful suffering. There is an alternative. There is an alternative to be with suffering in a skillful way. And I'm going to talk to you a little bit about this now. This is one of the stories that I have known about for probably about a year now, and it's kind of, you know, the rock upon which I build my church. Not this church, but the rock upon which I build the church of my consciousness and the way that I choose to relate to life. And this is a story about St. Francis, who is one of my heroes. And it's a story about St. Francis, well, I guess he wasn't a saint yet, but Francis and Leo, Brother Francis and Brother Leo, walking through the fields to get from one monastery to another. And it's a long walk, it's about 20 miles, and they're walking and they're talking, you know how you do, pass the time away, right? Talking about all kinds of things, hot babes, I don't know, probably not, but they're walking and they're talking, or that Sister Clara is really, no, never mind, okay. Okay, they're walking and they're talking, and Brother Leo starts asking Brother Francis, what is perfect joy? And Francis, in his monk-like way, says, well, why don't you tell me? So they walk a few miles more, and Brother Leo's pondering this question, and he says, I know. Perfect joy is when you can turn water into wine. And Francis says, no, that may be joyful, but that's not perfect joy. And then they walk a little bit further. Brother Leo continues to ponder it, and then they get to a few miles further on, and Leo says, oh, I know. Perfect joy is the ability to heal the sick. And Francis says, well, yes, that's joyful, but it's not perfect joy. So again, Leo ponders, they walk a few miles further, and then finally, close to their destination, Leo says, I know, perfect joy is the ability to raise the dead. And Francis says, sorry, no, That's joy, but that's not perfect joy. So they're walking and walking, and finally Leo gets frustrated, and he says, Francis, dude, tell me, what is perfect joy? Please, spit it out, okay? Tell us. And Francis says, perfect joy is if we arrive at the monastery. I'm suffering. If we arrive at the at the monastery, and we knock on the door, and the friar opens the door, and we tell him who we are, and he says, you are imposters. Go away. Go back to where you came from. I don't care if you're cold and wet and if you've been walking for 20 miles, and he slams the door. And if we can still see the Christ in him after that, then that is perfect joy. You get that? Perfect joy means inclusive of everything. It means loving your enemies. It means blessing those who curse you. It means that St. Francis automatically was in that place that is transcendent of suffering, probably because he embraced a lot of suffering and welcomed it and recognized that he doesn't have to make it too powerful. You know, when we push suffering away, we empower it. We empower it, and we cause it to be bigger than it needs to be. But when we welcome it, when we befriend it, then it has a magical, mystical way of taking us to that deeper place of interconnectivity with all beings. And I think that's at the heart of everything that we really want. So I have a somewhat mortifying story about a big mistake I made this week. Actually, I made it before, but it's an ongoing mistake that's following me around for a while, and I think it's interesting to me. I hope it's interesting to you. You may notice that our beautiful sign that we designed on Easter, that we revealed on Easter, that the artwork on it is covered up. Does anyone have a guess as to why that may be happening? Yes. Give that girl a chocolate chip cookie. She said copyright. What we did, we looked for the site on it, or we looked for the artwork on a sign that has legal images to use, but evidently we did not dig deep enough. And somebody who was in the service last Sunday came to me in the back of the line with a cell phone showing that sign on somebody else's webpage saying, this is a copyrighted image, you don't have the right to use this. So went home, pondered it, did my research on the site that said it was okay to use, and wrote her back and said, I think we do, but let me sit with this a little bit longer. In the meantime, she wrote me a couple of emails that I didn't get to right away, so they escalated a little bit in terms of intensity. I don't know how much is projection or how much is real. I did know that I needed to go to the place of thinking about Jesus and the money changers throwing, people out of the temple and just like this, right? Yeah. And, we've talked about this in class. David, who is a Meister Eckhart scholar, and I agree with this too, says that it doesn't really say that he was angry. He was just passionate. He just really, really wanted the right thing to happen, which is to get transactional consciousness out of the temple. And I feel this way about the emails that I was getting. It wasn't that she was angry. It wasn't that she was putting me down. It was that she was really passionate about us doing the right thing, about us having integrity about our sign. And that's a beautiful thing. That's a good thing. However, it took me a while to get to that place. Because in the first readings of the email, I was not in that place. I felt like I was being accused of not having any integrity by someone who doesn't know me well. And so I wrote several emails in my head. Fortunately, I was not at my computer, and I wrote several emails in my head driving in the car. And the gist of them were, let me see how sophisticated I can make this. Maybe I'll do it like Shakespeare. Thou art rubber, and I ameth glue. What bounceth, no, what you say bounceth off of me and sticketh to you. So that was kind of the gist of the initial emails that I wrote. But then, it's like, okay, you're defensive. You are suffering over your defensiveness. In fact, suffering can be all kinds of things. You know, in the book, he talks about how suffering is not only the big tragedies that we have. He says suffering is falling in love and then becoming complacent. Suffering is not being able to connect with our children. It's our anxiety about what will happen at work tomorrow. Suffering is knowing that your roof will leak in the next rainstorm. It is finally buying that shiny new smartphone, then seeing an advertisement for an even newer device with incremental improvements. It's hoping your company will get rid of your grumpy boss, Annette. It is thinking that life is moving by too fast or too slow, not getting what you want, getting what you don't want, or getting what you want but fearing you will lose it. All of this is suffering. And defensiveness, feeling like you have been attacked, feeling like you have been falsely accused, that's a form of suffering too, right? Anybody been there? Does anybody here love to be falsely accused? Okay, because it's super uncomfortable, isn't it, right? So I had to sit with, I noticed the defensiveness, I had to sit with it for a while and just keep breathing and breathing and breathing and doing the law of three and just asking God to show me what I was supposed to do, what was supposed to be revealed. And then I came up with that idea that it's like Jesus and the money changers, that she's just very passionate about what she wants to say, and of course I'm going to do the right thing. So I just wrote back to her and I said, there's absolutely no resistance here. But the thing about, you know, the thing about the St. Francis story where he allows the friar to slap him and verbally slap him and accuse him of being an imposter and all of that stuff, is that some people will take that and think that they have no rights. But that's not true. You still have rights. So in this email that I sent, I said, there's no resistance here. I intend to do the right thing, but I'm going to ask you to step back and let me do the right thing, because I understand the culture of the church, and I understand the consciousness that we're building here. And so it would be better if you let me do this. And I also invited her to practice pre-forgiveness in case we had made a mistake, right? Pre-forgiveness, a good thing to know about. And then it all cleared up. It all cleared up in terms of my relationship with her. It was beautiful. But then she gave me the name for the lawyer. Board President Brock sent him some lovely emails about what was going on. And it was coming down to making a decision, and I decided I was going to email him. And this is where it starts getting really beautiful, really into the interconnectedness, really into that place that is beyond suffering, that place where welcoming suffering can bring us to. In the email that I sent to the lawyer, I said, we are a culture of kindness and reconciliation. So if you don't want us to use that symbol, we don't want to use that symbol. We want you to be happy. A compromise is not good enough for us. We want a true win-win. Here's a link to our website. Look at our stuff. Look at what we do. If this feels like it's a good partnership, if it feels like it's a good partnership for your beautiful logo to hang in our sacred space, then we'll consider doing it. But if you in any way feel uncomfortable with this, that's not good for us. And if you say no, if you say we can't use your logo, then that also is a win for us, because it means that we have something better coming for us, right? Doesn't that make sense? Doesn't that make so much more sense than saying, we have a right to use that logo. It's an interfaith logo. What is wrong with you people? How come you're not sharing it? Right? That wore me out. What a story. What a story. So I haven't heard from the lawyer yet, but one of the things he says in this book is that there's such beauty in welcoming our suffering, because once you do, and you go to that place, and you go to that place of interconnectedness, and you recognize that the whole world is suffering in all of those ways that I read and more, that you start developing this deep compassion, not only for yourself, but for the other, where you can say, as I said to him at the end of the letter, I said, no piece of art is more important than your happiness or than our shared integrity. Right? And that's just so true. That's so real. Now, the willingness to be with suffering in a skillful and noble and honest way leads us from the unreal to the real. It also leads to joy. You know, that story about St. Francis and perfect joy, it's no coincidence that perfect joy came up, because I found such joy in letting go. Such joy in letting go that will translate and has translated this week into many, many other situations. It's also no coincidence that our psychic choir director chose the St. Francis chant as people were coming in. It always happens, Mary. You just know. We did not talk about this beforehand. But, you know, some of you know me and know that I have a strange sense of humor, and that You know, sometimes my joy leads to strange places that are delightful, and I've been planning this joke all week, so I hope you So, you know, in the discussion about what to do in case we can't use the logo, and honestly, I'm at the place where I'm not sure if I even want to use it anymore, because if it has a bad feeling attached to it, then I don't, the space is too pure, it doesn't need that. I started thinking about some other possible options for logos, and I want to share some of those with you. Here's the first one. Balcony. Now, some of you may be wondering why I'm holding up a picture of a large rodent in church, but it's a guinea pig, and I have a whole history with guinea pigs that I won't go into, but one of the sweet church stories is that Jennifer's children, when they were little, and they were super rowdy, I don't know if they're still rowdy, but they were super rowdy when they were little. What the dickens is going on with this? Let me just fix this once and for all. When they were super little, was that... We used to hide a guinea pig in the program, a picture of a guinea pig in the program, and we'd say, find the guinea pig, boys. And that would give them something to do at the beginning of church. So, I don't know, can you see it? The other option for a design is something that I think is appropriate, because we have a lot of people that claim to be recovering Catholics that struggle with a tragic Christian past. So I have this picture of my dog dressed up like a nun. And I think that that would be really, really special up there. And the third one is just so ridiculous, I can barely even bear to say it. Ah, the law of comedy is a law of three, too, just so you know. So you know the third one's going to be the best, right? This is a picture of our former choir director, Todd, who used to like to dress up as a woman sometimes. And I think we must have taken this picture when he was having a bad day. So I want you to, in your mind's eye, when I hold this up, visualize this up there, okay? Here we go. Oh, I just got chills. Yeah, you picked Todd, you're voting for Todd. Yeah. So you see how joyful mistakes can be, right? You know, in one of the classes I teach, and also in some of the work I'm doing with Nipun, we talk about successful fails. That was such a successful fail because it brought me and it brought all of us to a place of greater insight, greater connection, and greater joy. Is that so totally cool instead? But if I had gotten defensive and if I had acted out on the feeling like I was being falsely accused, then I would not be in this place of great joy and great peace and great equanimity. And the same thing is available for you. One more thing I want to say about the sign before I make this a little more personal for you all, because it's been all about me so far, which is fine, but hopefully it's about all of us. is that in one of our endeavors to cover up the logo that we're not allowed to use, we got a plate, Annette got a plate, and put heart pins all over it, heart pins made by the women in the slums of India. And that actually looks really pretty, and we have that taped over it on the sign there, but it kept falling off, and we didn't want anybody to see that logo ever again, unless we're permitted to use it. But, you know, she put it up, she sent me the picture, and then all of a sudden I panicked again, because I'm a little paranoid about picking copyrighted images now, for good reason. And I sent it to Nipun and said, by the way, this is what we're doing. He knew the whole story. I hope this is okay. And Nipun wrote back to me, and he said, you know, Bonnie, I got to tell you, copyright, copy wrong. We're not even on that spectrum. And then he put, hashtag, please steal our stuff. So what's going to be really embarrassing is if this other organization says, you can use our logo, thank you, God. And I'm going to say, yeah, I'm thinking we're going someplace else. We'll see what happens, we'll figure it out, and it's all going to be beautiful. In fact, it has been beautiful already. It's been a beautiful process. So what I encourage all of us to do is to just take these ideas and walk with them in a very personal way in our own lives. Recognize for a moment, if you would, someplace where you're suffering. It can be something from that list of what I spoke about, or it can be a feeling of guilt or a feeling of shame, a feeling of defensiveness, something that you've done wrong, a mistake. And just hold that energy in your heart and just allow yourself to feel the feelings. And as you feel the feelings, know that you're in a supportive community and that we've all got something, that you're just not as unique in your shame and your guilt and your challenges as you might think you are, that the whole human race has that going on. And it's there for a purpose. It's there to awaken us to skillfulness. It's there to awaken us to the opposite of suffering. It's there to awaken us to befriending. It's there to awaken us to witnessing. It's there to awaken us to compassion, self-compassion, compassion for self, compassion for other, compassion for the whole human race that is engaged in this mystical process of opposites, that when we transcend those opposites, we recognize that there is no suffering, that there is no wrongdoing, that there is no right doing. There is only a field, and we meet in that field, and the world is too full to talk about. And words like you and me and don't use my stuff and all of that makes no sense. So breathe in, know that truth for yourself, and then gently exhale, recognizing that this will continue to grow if you continue to do this work. And with that being said, I'm going to invite someone who has used these principles in her life to come forward and enlighten us. Reverend Judy Pando, who is a minister here, a staff minister, and also a chaplain.
And I have 3 minutes to talk about a very complicated subject and a subject that is very close to my heart, and that is the concept of suffering. Now, I have suffered that in that whole list of stuff that you...
Oh, the whole thing?
Personally, yes.
I'm sorry.
Yeah. And I believe, as Ernest Holmes believes, that we have learned all that we can from that form of suffering, that that kind of suffering is overcomable, that that kind of suffering is there to teach us something, and then we can just sort of let it go. I want to talk a little bit more about a different kind of suffering, though, the kind of suffering that I have personally experienced in the last few years and that I have experienced along with my patients as in my work as a hospice chaplain and bereavement counselor. And that is the subject of death. I mean, that is the subject of a very transformational type of suffering that we're all going to get to encounter at one point or another in our lives. And I encountered that a few years ago when my husband passed away, and then my father a year later, and I experienced pain and suffering. And all of those wonderful existential questions came up for me. Who am I now? What's my role if I'm no longer his wife or his daughter? What's my purpose in life? What's meaningful to me now? I can never go back to being the old normal. I have to find a new normal. And I spent a lot of time resisting that. And then I became reconciled to it. There's that word again. And I found new opportunities to go deeper in my life. I deepened in my spirituality. I deepened in my learning. I deepened in my growth. And I became a completely different person. And I've used these skills that I learned through that process in my work in hospice and bereavement. And I have to tell you, it has been such an inspiring journey. I want to tell you one story about a gentleman that I encountered. I went to his house to visit. His wife was on hospice. And they had a beautiful home. They were obviously prosperous. They were very well educated. They were very well traveled. And they loved each other very much. And they had a wonderful family and a wonderful life. And then she got early onset Alzheimer's. And he became her caretaker. And he was, of course, thrown for a loop. His beautiful wife could no longer communicate with him, and he had to do everything for her and be with her in every minute. And he didn't know how to do this. I mean, who knows how to do that until you have to do that? And he got help, and he went to counseling, and he deepened in his spirituality so completely that he said he developed so much compassion and so much kindness that he didn't know he was capable of doing that, of going there. And I thought, oh, yes, yes, reconciliation. Thank you, God. This is a beautiful story. And I was so inspired by him because, and I work with people who are experiencing grief every day, deep grief. And grief is not something that is overcomeable. You don't just get over it. You don't. It is completely transformational. You have to reconcile to it to become a different person. But there is hope. There is hope in all the sadness, in grief, and I'm really a strong proponent of the statement that grief shared is almost joy. Mm-hmm. Because it is so individualized in each one of us. We each experience it differently, and yet it's so universal at the same time. So there is hope. There is hope. And like my gentleman in the story, we don't do it alone. Most of us need each other to go through this process, to come out on the other side in a healthy way. So I encourage you, if you feel that you are grieving and stuck in your grief and feeling the pain, seek out a practitioner. They will see your wholeness when you feel like you're completely broken apart. Or come to a grief group. Find a grief counselor. Grief counselors are not experts in the field of grief. They are simply companions to journey with you while you uncover your greater good. Many people who experience grief have also experiences of PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. But I'm here to tell you that there is another way to go, that you can go from there into post-traumatic stress growth. And I invite you to, I invite you to seek that out and consider that as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Judy. Thank you. Thank you. Quick quote to close with from the featured book, The Five Invitations. The willingness to be with our suffering gives rise to an eternal resourcefulness that we carry forward into all areas of our lives. We learn that whatever we give space to can move. Turning toward our suffering is a critical part of welcoming everything and pushing nothing away. This invitation means that no part of ourselves or our experience can be left out, not the joy and wonder, nor the pain and anguish. All are woven throughout the very fabric of our lives. When we embrace that truth, we step more fully into life. Let us step more fully into life now as we pray. And so turning within, we breathe, we inhale, we exhale, we allow ourselves to be. And in this spaciousness, we recognize that there truly is only one perfect life. Perfect is inclusive of everything, and that's perfect life is God. It is wholeness, it is love, it is joy. It is that beyond what we know. But we can feel it, we intuit it. In the heart space, in the body space, in the mind space, and in the space of being. Let us connect with that spaciousness of life and allow it to lead us into remembering who we truly are, that we are that life of God, that we are that spaciousness, that we are that goodness, and that this goodness is available in every single detail of our lives. But paradoxically, we receive this goodness by being authentic, by being real with what is, by recognizing that the truth does not operate in a lie. And so we welcome what is, and we welcome what we're feeling about what it is. But we don't have to empower it excessively through resistance or denial or trying to push it away. We simply welcome it and dialogue with it and befriend it. And ultimately, it lets us go, or we let it go, as we move and evolve into a greater place of hope and transformation and transcendence. And so I know this truth for every single person sitting in this sanctuary today, whether we are suffering over a possible leaky roof, or whether we are struggling over the loss of a loved one, that there is beauty, that there is hope, and that there is great love. And that love guides us through the process to what is most right and real and authentic for reconnecting us to that which we have never left, our oneness, our interconnectivity with all beings, our compassion. And so I'm so grateful for this powerful truth, so grateful for the healing that I know is taking place here today as we join together as a spiritual community, so grateful for love and life and goodness. I bless the spiritual center as I bless all paths to God, churches, temples, synagogues, mosques, ashrams, all paths. And with a heart that is so filled with blessedness, I say, thank you, Spirit. Thank you, God. And I release these words into the divine mystery. And together we say, and so it is.